Yeah, the Soulcast is back, motherfuckers. Yeah, what up? Back up in this. Real talk, I put this shit on hiatus for the last year. Kind of, I don't know, my father died, so I was just smoking a lot of hash oil. But fuck it, we back now. Today's first guest for the second season is my man Graham Klumpner from Iraq Veterans Against the War. We're going to be talking about a ton of shit. Everything from the climate crisis to the militarization of police to how veterans can play an important role in social movements and a ton of other shit. So keep your hats on and your middle fingers up. We in this motherfucker. Ha ha! Graham, welcome to the Soulcast.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Yeah, well, you're the first person I've interviewed in my studio, so I hope you feel lucky, man. This is all the clothes stuffed. It's a shithole in here. Let's be honest. You
know, it's an artist's dream.
And it fucking smells. All right, so you are with a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Yeah, so Iraq Veterans Against the War is about 10 years old, and we started in 2004 when the first troops started coming home from Iraq, and it first started basically trying to capture the fact that the media was telling one story and the American soldiers were experiencing another. And it expanded. I mean, by the end of 2005, we were talking about Afghanistan, and we were talking about imperialism here and there and starting to connect the dots that it's not just about this war or that war, that it's a structural problem with the United States.
All right, well, that was actually surprising to me to find out that Iraq Veterans Against the War was actually an anti-imperialist organization. Is that recent? Has that been happening for a
while? Yeah, so the actual terms that we use are like militarism. So imperialism is something that probably is a little bit more accurate, but you know, language is important, and in order to really talk about what the United States does and how it gets its resources and how it continues to be really an incredibly rich country. Of course, the wealth is concentrated in certain areas, but compared to a lot of other places in the world, this country is incredibly rich, and a lot of that is due to stolen resources or, you know, cheap resources that we get sold to us at our prices. So that evolution took a long time, and it was a battle that we had to, you know, I frame it as a battle because as a soldier, that's how I view things. And we had to have those internal discussions. You know, we had to ask questions about if we are able to end the Iraq War, which is unpopular among, you know, the majority of Americans, liberals especially, you know, they got on board after they supported it. You know, the Iraq War is a no-brainer. It's black and white for most Americans, except for Dick Cheney. Now, Afghanistan, Libya, Sudan, you know, these other places that were involved either directly or indirectly, Pakistan, these are more gray areas, especially with Afghanistan because it was the good war, right? And some people,
it's a good war that we never fought.
Yes, absolutely. Like, we could have targeted, really made an effort to go after those who attacked us or those who, you know, in a lot of ways we funded. We funded 8 different groups that, you know, the Haqqani group, for example, is one of the 8 that we funded in the 1980s. And, you know, at the time, Reagan was pretty happy that we had these good, God-fearing people fighting the atheist Soviet Union, you know. And at that time, you know, the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan. So we were willing, the United States was willing to work with anybody that was going to kill Soviet soldiers. And in a lot of ways, if you look at what the administration was saying and what the Defense Department was saying, you have to understand, in the early 80s, you're 5 to 7 years removed from Vietnam. And the Soviets funded the North Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. So there was this concept of revenge. We have to go in and get them, right? So we, you know, only about 15,000 Soviets died. In Vietnam, it was 57,000 Americans and 2 million Vietnamese. So it wasn't, you know, equal as the Defense Department would like it to be. But a lot of people cite the support for the Mujahideen, the Holy Warriors, in Pakistan and Afghanistan for defeating not only the Soviet Union in open battle, but also bringing about the end of the Soviet Union, and as Francis Fukuyama likes to talk about, the end of history. We could talk about that on some other level. But
history is definitely not over.
No, it's definitely not. Now, in terms of...
ours might be.
Well, ours as human beings with climate, yeah, we've definitely dug ourselves a pretty big hole. In terms of Afghanistan, when we look at what happened after, the Soviet Union begins to crumble basically in 1989, and they pull their troops out, the 40th Army crosses the border, and that's it. After that, the United States withdrew all financial support from Afghanistan and Pakistan. And this is really important because this is a recurring theme around the world, and the world understands, other countries, the people understand this, that the United States will come and support them if it meets our needs. When those needs are no longer relevant, we take off. And so for a couple of years, there was, a communist government still in charge, and it devolved into civil war. So from 1992 to 1996, you basically had Afghans fighting each other, Pashtuns versus Farsiwan versus Tajiks and Uzbeks, the Hazara, which is a product of the Mongol invasions from hundreds of years ago. They were almost essentially wiped out by the Sunnis, by the Pashtuns, when the Taliban took power. So you have a whole vacuum of power. The United States is not involved at all. They're focused on Europe. They're focused on the Balkans, other major issues in the 90s, buying your second, resort home and getting a second car. Those things were priorities for Americans. So by 1996, you have complete lawlessness in the country and in Afghanistan. And out of this comes a law and order and justice party. And you see this all over the world. When there's chaos, people are willing to forego certain values or morals that they have for security. And so the Taliban come into this, and it's important to talk about what the Taliban is. Talib, and the Taliban is the plural of it. Talib means student of Islam. It means a studier of Islam, a participant. It's not just reading books, it's living those values. And these people came in and they said, we're going to establish justice and order. So, they cut people's arms off if they stole. If you, sexually abused somebody or raped somebody that wasn't your wife, then you could be stoned to death. So there was...
Rape someone that wasn't your wife.
Right, you can totally rape your wife. That's totally tolerable. And it's important to understand where this ideology comes from. So in the early 80s, you have millions of Afghans fleeing across the border into Pakistan. Now, that's to the east. And they're fleeing across the border to escape the Soviet invasion. They're fleeing because there's unrest and, this was a place, Afghanistan in the 60s that the Beatles went to. This is a place that artists went through, and it was, there was ski resorts. This was like a Western vacation. There was a middle class. It wasn't as powerful as Iraq, but they've actually got a higher population than Iraq, around 31 million, as best as we can guess. So you have millions of refugees crossing into Pakistan. The Pakistani government is unstable at this point. They've just transitioned from a civilian to a military dictatorship. And they don't know what to do. In comes Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's got the money, they've got the largest oil reserves in the world, and they've got a brand of Islam that you just can't get at the corner store.
Wahhabism.
So they bring in Wahhabism, and they fund over 10,000 madrasas, these religious schools. And we,
How do you define Wahhabism? Mm-hmm. How do you define it?
Well, Wahhabism is a Sunni. It's only Sunni Muslims, and Sunnis make up the large majority of Muslims around the world. Upwards of 90%.
Because most terrorists are Wahhabists, correct?
I don't know that I can make that statement. I would say that most
Whatever a terrorist is.
Well, let's put it this way: Al Qaeda is solely full of Wahhabis. Okay, ISIS. I think the Islamic State in Syria, or the Islamic State in the Levant, whatever we're calling it. They are made up of Sunnis, totally. There's no Shia in there. They believe Shia are heretics or unbelievers, as bad, if not worse, than atheists, depending on who you ask. There's... When the United States occupied Iraq, there was definitely a lot of Shia resistance as well to the United States occupation. It was, it was more of a nationalist resistance than it was an ideological resistance. But in Afghanistan... There was not, for Afghans, there was not a lot of history of religious extremism. You know, for example, the burqa. The burqa is a rich, it comes, you know, historically in Afghanistan, it comes from, it was a style for the rich. Rich women didn't want to show off their bodies to the people, to the proletariat, right? And later on, it gets adopted in the middle 1900s, it gets adopted as something that is fashionable. So if the rich are doing it, we want to adopt it. We do this in our country. And it gets adopted as a religious symbol. Certain people interpreted, you know, the Quran or, you know, later writings that were not part of the original Quran, but they interpret these things as saying that
the
women,
Hadith,
yeah, that certain women should not be, you know, out in the public and they should not be seen. And that's generally in the West, that's what we see and we react to that and we're like, this is horrible. And if you ask, you know, some Muslims who practice, like, wear an abaya or wear a burqa or whatever, a lot of them, you know, some of them will tell you that it's actually a women's rights thing. This is for my husband. This is for my, you know, when I take my clothes off or when I'm, you know, showing myself off, it's for the person I'm in love with. It's not for the neighbor. It's not for, you know.
Yeah, it's not as black and white as motherfuckers were.
No, it's not at all. And so, really, when we look at, like, the history of Afghanistan, like, the CIA has a term, blowback. And, you know, I'm sure the listeners have heard that, but it really comes down to this idea that we are short-sighted and that we make decisions based on a year, 2 years, 3 years, what we want now, and we don't look in the long term. And you can see this with Iraq, funding Iraq and giving them, you know, chemical weapons in the 1980s, giving them anthrax. ISIS last year. Really, like, we make these short-term decisions to try to, you know, react as opposed to being, like, visionary about the future. So we funded, and a lot of people can make the argument it was a good decision at the time. I mean, I'm not going to argue with that. I have my criticisms, but... we funded these 8 different fundamentalist groups that recruited out of all of these refugee centers. And these folks had nothing to lose. You know, these Soviets had invaded their country. They wanted to go back. Afghanistan has an entire history of rejecting imperial rule from the Mongols up to today. They overthrew the British. They fought 4 wars against the British and kicked them out. You know, and they fought the Soviets and kicked them out, and they're about to kick out the Americans. So there's a legacy, a pride. There's this term called Pashtunwali, which is, it's like a Pashtun moral code. And it's very simple. It comes down to, like, if a guest comes to your house, you have to take them in. The next morning when they leave, you can shoot them in the back, but when they're in your home, you take care of them. It's an honor code. And that honor code governs especially how men react in society, what masculinity means, and how relationships are structured. It's very different than the West. And it's difficult for, like, Western military personnel or state personnel to really understand. You know, we try to, like, box people in, give them Jeffersonian democracy. People don't understand that. So in a lot of ways, like, the statement that we trained the Taliban, it's true, but it requires an extra couple of sentences. It's not just we trained the Taliban. We did provide weapons. We never directly funded bin Laden, for example. We funded people who associated and fought with bin Laden. He had $300 million. He had enough money to fund his own shit. And it was mostly construction stuff. But we definitely funded these people, and then we left in the late 1980s. The country devolves into civil war, becomes basically completely a failed state. And by the late 1990s, the United States has pushed bin Laden and al-Qaeda out of the Sudan, out of Saudi Arabia, both of them allies to the United States, and they find a home in Afghanistan. No stable government. They're only recognized by 3 other countries, Qatar, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia. Oh, I think Pakistan, actually, so maybe 4. So by the time 9/11 happens, there's not a lot of support for the Taliban. And then you see, you know, the demands. Initially, it was just give up bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And it after the Bonn conference in, like, December of 2001, where they tried to form a government, it suddenly becomes we've got to remove the Taliban. And the Taliban are an indigenous, local, religious force in Afghanistan. They are Afghans. They are not Arabs. They're Afghan. And that's a huge thing to understand, because most Americans think that the Taliban and al-Qaeda are the same thing. They come from Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, North Korea. Like, you got to understand this nuance. It's important for us to, you know, be able to address issues in the future. We find ourselves in tons of problems right now because we can't handle nuance.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, you spent a lot of time in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Yes.
you were with JSOC, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is the Joint Special Operation Command.
That's correct.
Well, in your experience in the kind of, did you like hang out in the lawless regions? Did you hang out in the places where like the state was weak? Like, did you learn anything about, you know, what will fucking collapse be like, you know, when we have a failed state here? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
What was it like being in those places where there's no government? I mean, were you always camoed up and stealth?
Yeah, so I was an Army Ranger, and Army Rangers are considered to be some of the best light infantry in the world, and light's a relative term, means 100-pound packs you're carrying. But the job of a ranger at the outset of a war is to parachute into the airfields and take them over, and then from there you do snatch and grab missions, or in the United States, SWAT teams, essentially. Same thing. JSOC is comprised...
It is the same thing, huh?
Yeah, it's absolutely the same thing. And I mean, it wasn't 15 years ago. You know, we had, I think I saw a number, but 2001 we had, or excuse me, in the year 2000 we had 3,000 SWAT raids. Now we have 50,000 a year. And we've gone from this...
What, do you know anything about the relationship between the militarization?
Absolutely.
Talk about that. I'm going to... We'll circle what is the stateless utopia like.
Yeah, no, that's good. So in terms of the relationship, I mean, this is why IVAW chose to focus on militarism. Part of it is coalition building, and part of it is just an analysis to understand how power operates, and when power learns an effective tactic, it gets spread everywhere. So there was a document in 1998 that was written by the Project for New American Century that most people who are interested in these things will probably have read, but the key line of it was was basically that short of a Pearl Harbor-like event, the reforms, and those reforms were very specific. They were reforms in terms of increased military spending, increased imperialism overseas, and increased police presence and surveillance in the United States. And keep in mind, this is before they understood the internet could be really valuable for thought control.
Didn't they also think that, like, short of Pearl Harbor-like event, but didn't they specifically say UFOs? An alien invasion in that document?
They use it as a reference, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that they were, you know, totally serious, but you never quite know with these people. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney and some of the unsung all-stars that keep getting on the news somehow.
So, but the Project for New American Century talked about surveillance?
Yeah, they talked about surveillance as a caveat, or not caveat, but as a support for... really pushing in these reforms that they wanted. And they were very broad, you know, not specific on what they wanted, but it's, you know, we've had the last 13 years. We know exactly what they wanted. They got it. So in terms of the relationship between, you know, the police state that we've lived in for some time, but, you know, white people, I think, are just starting to discover that it exists. And that's a fun experience for people. Shout out to Scott Olson. But in terms of the police state, part of this is just the byproduct of war. When you drop billions of dollars, and let's be clear, Iraq itself cost $4 trillion, and that's not even taking into account veterans' health care or reparations in any sense or reconciliation. That's a lot of money. I mean, that's like a quarter of our debt, you know? And so, not that the debt matters, it's all fake, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm just trying to give some reference. So in terms of the transfer, like, when you have all of this equipment and you fight a war and then you come home, you don't know what to do with the equipment. So in a lot of cases, like in Afghanistan, currently, we're just giving it to the Afghans. We're giving them MRAPs, which are like anti-mine resistant tanks. We're giving them Humvees and Apaches. We've done the same thing in Iraq. Like, you see now ISIS is driving around American Humvees while we gave them to the Iraqi government that we thought was our allies. A lot of that equipment comes home too. And so, you know, here we are in Denver. The city of Denver has two tanks. You know, they've got armored personnel carriers. They've got the ability to shut down, to do crowd control and shut down folks. You know, some of that has been under the guise of Homeland Security. But in a lot of cases, you know, if you watch the news, there's police departments that are actually saying, we don't want this. We're not trained on this. We don't need this. We're in Bellingham, Washington. Like, it's not necessary to have tanks here, guys. So really... let's just be honest. There's something sexy about the military, especially, you know, kicking doors down, shooting shit. Like, we have an entire media that's based around that. I know plenty of people, including myself, that had a powerful factor in me joining the military. I wanted to be a hero. I wanted to you know, kick ass and take names and be proud of that and have people shake my hand. I mean,
yeah, you said you wanted to go to Afghanistan and make a difference.
I want to go to Afghanistan and kill
Bin
Laden.
Do you want
to
slap the shit out of yourself?
No. And the reason is, and this kind of goes to like a deeper point about like the relationship between civilians and veterans, but I want to know why other people didn't join. That's what I want to know. I'm not angry at myself so much as I'm frustrated that we have a government and a culture that has so destroyed civic participation. And I don't mean like from the nation state. I don't mean government instituted participation. I mean communities. We are individuals so much. You take care of your own shit. Don't ask your neighbor for milk. Like, there's no reason. You know, you need to get a job and take care of yourself and lift up your goddamn bootstraps. You know, I have some questions about people not even having boots. So I,
yeah, totally.
You know, but I guess in terms of serving in a war, I made the best decision with my heart that I could with the information that I had. And
how old were you?
I was 19.
And how old are you now?
I'm 20. I'm 30 now. I just turned 30. And I really, you know, when 9/11 happened, it had an incredibly profound impact on me. And I was very patriotic before that, but 9/11 turned me from like supporting Al Gore into, you know, our president, right or wrong, our country, right or wrong, love it or leave it. And, you know, I was like, if these people are going to attack us, like, we need to go find them. We need to go remove them from the planet. And, you know, I learned a lot of truths in that experience, but, I can't fault people, again, for making... This is an indictment of the media, of our culture, of our families, of the fact that it's not comfortable in a Christian, you know, evangelical or like a Christian hegemonic society to be honest. Like, if people had been able to be honest and have this honest conversation, I would never have joined the military. So, to me, like, I don't think, you know, faulting I think that the soldiers who go overseas... that's one point of view. When they come home, that's what determines your judgment of them. How they behave when they learn what they've learned. If they go,
I mean, unless
right
they're
wing,
out,
you know,
committing fucking war crimes.
Well, know. and that's another thing. I mean, this is where like the nuance comes in, and it's difficult because like I participated in war crimes. I mean, you can make the argument absolutely that the Iraq War itself was a war crime, that just because the United Nations supported Afghanistan and NATO supported Afghanistan, that's a war crime, that they invoked Charter 5, that's a war crime. Like, so when you get down to the level of, I was promoted up to sergeant, so I, you know, 4 years, you get to an E5, that's a pretty low rank, you're commanding three men or women, but you're still pretty low in the totem pole in the American media. You know, there's a concept that, or in the American psyche, there's a concept that, oh, you know, if you get a bad order, you just refuse. If you get a bad order, if you are ordered to do something in a war zone and you refuse, you have the right to be shot. Okay? So this idea that you can go to the drugstore and choose to buy soda or not buy soda, and that's a moral choice, is bullshit. There are so many social pressures. You've been trained for 4 to 6 months. You've been indoctrinated. Everyone around you is doing the same thing. For you to have critical thinking is frowned upon, to say the least. So to ask a low-level soldier to make a decision, that's why we support people like Bradley or Chelsea Manning so much. I mean, Chelsea Manning made a choice, put her life on the line, and spending 35 years in prison. I had access to the same data she did, and I never, ever crossed my mind that the American people should have access to that. And that's what I look in the mirror and ask myself every day. That's what I'm pissed about.
But, I mean, you became a conscious objector.
Well,
so.
I mean, after I left. I mean, if I had become one in the military, and there's not a lot in JSOC, let's be clear. When you look at the resistance, the military, like veteran-led resistance, overwhelmingly, it's National Guard and Reserve soldiers. You do have active duty. Those active duty tend to be closer to the fight, closer to the trauma. But to go into the special operations community, where you get 30% of the entire army's budget, when you get all of the resources, the air support, the transportation, new flak vests, we never had equipment problems. You heard all this stuff about normal soldiers not having body armor. We had 3 sets of body armor in 4 years, like different sets. We were cycling and testing shit. So though that community is protected, and they're not, it's highly unlikely that they're going to turn against the system.
A lot of people probably don't. I mean, the only reason I know what JSOC is because I watched the Jeremy Scahill documentary on Netflix, Dirty Wars. But a lot of people don't. What is JSOC?
JSOC is the Joint Special Operations Command.
It's kind of like the Illuminati of the world, right? It's like
yes, in a manner of speaking. So JSOC was formed after Operation Noble Eagle, I think it was, or Blue something. So anyway,
that's redundant.
Well, our names
Eagles are already noble. I mean.
Well, we have to spell it out. This is America. but we actually after the Iran hostage crisis in 1979-1980. President Carter sent in a special operations team. It failed miserably. 2 helicopters crashed, and it was and that led to Reagan being elected. And you know, then he sold weapons for arms and got the hostages back. But that's, you know, that's a different negotiating with terror issue. But after that, the military, and keep in mind they're recovering from what they call this Vietnam syndrome at the time. The military decides that it needs a special operations command. JSOC is born out of that. Initially, it just has Army Rangers, Navy SEALs. It eventually has this new group called CAG, the Combat Action Group, or what the civilian community knows it as is Delta Force. There's also Air Force personnel, like parachute jumpers that go rescue downed pilots. But most of JSOC's job, it's all cohesive. So it's literally Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard combined. And this is very rare. Usually commands don't operate together. But the goal is to do all of the black things that, you know, you see in the nice movies, but you never see on TV. You know, somebody winds up dead. You never know who did it or how it happened. And JSOC, after 9/11, primarily became kill teams.
And JSOC's active in like 90 countries right now, right?
I would say more than that. I would say in terms of the training apparatus, the Green Berets are part of there. They do a large amount. I mean, Green Berets, their entire concept is based around send a 12-man team in, train 200 soldiers. It's a force multiplier. So in terms of bang for your buck, that's probably the best investment for U.S. taxpayers if you like imperialism. but JSOC, yeah, it's in Iraq, you know, at the height of Iraq, 2006, 2007, you had Stanley McChrystal, who eventually took over Afghanistan and was fired because of the Michael Hastings article. You know, he's probably like the rock star. Petraeus was in charge for a little while.
Our police chief Petraeus.
Petraeus, yeah. I don't think he's that effective at killing people.
He's effective at killing movements.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
JSOC.
So JSOC's role is really to do the dirty work, and you know, the regular military, their job is really to fight wars. Like, if you talk to infantry folks, they were not trained for peacekeeping or police actions. They were trained to close with and kill the enemy. And in what we call asymmetric warfare, which is what basically we're going to face no matter what, because no one wants to fight us straight up, because we'll fucking destroy them. Asymmetric warfare is when you have, like, improvised explosive devices, or you have snipers, or you have assassinations, things that are, like, what we call low-intensity warfare. It's not low-intensity for those there, but it's not, you know, the Nazis invading the Netherlands. So JSOC has also come under a lot of fire, and I would absolutely confirm this from, like, Jeremy Scahill and other folks like that who talked about the private prisons, the black sites. So just to paint a very broad picture, we would get intelligence from the CIA, Army Intelligence, or a source that we had. They would then cross-check that. They would provide us the intelligence with a target site. We would go, we would leave the base at 1:30, 1:30 in the morning. We would go to a target. We would kick it in at about 3 a.m., kick in the doors, clear the rooms, find the target, remove them, kill them or remove them. If they had a weapon, they'd be killed, and if they didn't, we could take them into custody. They'd be transported to a black site for 15 days. At that point, they would be looked at to see, is this a dirt farmer, or is this somebody who, like, is, you know, Al-Qaeda?
What do you mean? What's a dirt farmer?
So dirt,
that sounds racist.
Incredibly derogatory. Absolutely. So a dirt farmer is probably the least racist term that I can come up with. You know, that the U.S. military uses, but it's somebody who is doing something that is totally not political, not involved with, and obviously nobody actually farms dirt, but like the judgment of a place like Afghanistan, which has been devastated by, you know, deforestation. There's no soil in a lot of places. So these people trying to like find a subsistence living after the Soviet Union destroyed everything, the Civil War destroyed even more, and then the Americans come in and like try to shut down the drug, the heroin and opium trade,
or take it over.
And there's literally nothing.
Do you know anything about shit like that happening?
Well, in terms of...
I heard it was actually still happening, that CIA or whatever was still flying in opium.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. And it's interesting because in the United States, when we talk about the reasons that we're going over there, it's like, well, we need to go find Al-Qaeda or we need to, you know, stop the terrorists. If you go to the United Kingdom, the entire argument for deploying to Afghanistan is keeping heroin off of our streets. So, the United States doesn't really talk about that. Britain was put in charge of drug mitigation, and you know, the different countries like NATO, you got to understand, is like 28 so countries that are involved.
Do, you know?
Right now, they're great at that. So, you know, do your drug mitigation. But no, I don't know any. I mean, I can't like cite facts on the CIA transporting thing, but I can definitely talk about the CIA in the past, and you know, Central and South America and South Vietnam, and you know. We have a legacy of breaking rules that don't suit us. And I think we need to stop putting both soldiers and military personnel, as well as the U.S. government, on a pedestal and imagining that they're perfect. Like, they're human beings, they make choices, and they're part of a system. And that system determines most of the time what choices they make.
Well, it's so funny because I've been bumping up against libertarians every once in a while. I'm like, I was just thinking today about, like, this fucking Constitution this, Constitution that, mm-hmm. you know.
Fuck the Constitution.
Yeah, it's like our rights don't derive from the Constitution.
No.
When you were talking about JSOC, I was thinking of Call of Duty. and I was just picturing those like thermo great. Images and like, you know, clicking Y to switch to the drone. What relationship do you see between the video game industry and the military? Or the war apparatus?
No, that's a really good question. I think there's two things there. There's the drone aspect, which is like actually more convoluted than it seems, and the my aspect, which is like the on the ground, the soldier with the gun shooting
people. The first person shooter.
Yeah, that's actually more accurate. So when I joined the military, Call of Duty didn't exist. There was this unspoken video game morality that you didn't make video games about modern events. You could make today's guns, but they had to fight aliens, right? If you made a video game, it had to be World War II. Call of Duty did World War II. They fucking rocked that for a while, became so popular, and they decided to come out with a modern warfare type. I don't know if it was called that, but they came out with the first one that changed everything. I joined the military before that was happening. And I started seeing in 2007, I got out in 2007, so I started seeing right at the end there, and now as I recruit, you know, veterans all the time, it had a profound impact. People are playing this. They're getting into, you know, human beings are story-based creatures. We love stories. That's how we identify ourselves, whether it's religion or whether you're an atheist or whatever. You're identifying with a storyline and what that means for your life. Video games can help provide that, just like books and movies and all this stuff. And our media is more powerful than we ever imagined. We get more from the Fourth Estate than we get from any of the first three. So in terms of Call of Duty, I don't think the question of, like, is it accurate or not is even relevant. I mean, I think, yes, incredibly, in a lot of ways, it is accurate, except for the restart button and the replay button. You know, once you get shot, you're fucking shot, and that's it, so in real life. But I definitely think that there's... Now, here's a relationship that's really fucked up about this. So Call of Duty donates to the Wounded Warrior Program. The Wounded Warrior Program is something that a lot of Americans have really supported, like multi-million-dollar industry or, you know, nonprofit organization. They've done some great work. I have criticisms. Those criticisms are specifically around the fact that they focus a lot on physical injury, not psychological. They tend to focus on the combat role, which tends to favor male soldiers. And there's also been some like financial concerns, but the key part of the Call of Duty wounded warrior relationship is that Call of Duty helps recruit soldiers to go overseas to get their limbs blown off so that Wounded Warrior can take care of them. And I mean, that is a sick relationship. Yeah, I mean, it's like tobacco funding. I don't even know what the fuck, like children's parties or something, but it's like, it's a sick relationship. And you know, I think you can expand that to groups like Walmart that will drop hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, the Veterans Green Jobs just closed here in Denver. They were trying to focus on green energy, but they could only get grants from places like Walmart. So guess how much green energy they were able to focus on? No,
yeah, what they, I remember hearing about this project was trumped, was a was a big deal for the last 5 years, and so that never happened.
It just closed. I mean, there was a lot of great training that went in. I mean, like we have to give credit where credit's due. They did a lot in terms of education, especially around insulation, because really we could fix like 80% of our problems with insulation of our houses if we do it properly. We don't waste the energy. But they also like found ways to, you know, move what is renewable energy, what is green energy. They were able to say certain things that you and I may not agree is green energy.
Fracking.
Was yeah, like fracking, and you know, it's natural gas.
Well, this is Colorado. In Colorado, that is green.
Right, it is green. I mean, the airport's running commercials on NPR every day about that. Yeah. So not that I listen to NPR, but it's problematic. So
it was just bought up, you know, mega billionaire runs NPR now. So it's I actually heard that in LA they're doing LA is a pilot program for actual paid programs.
Really?
They're calling it viewer supported. But you know who's watching? It's fracking companies and shit. So that's fucked up. So yeah, LA's a beta test ground for the new for-profit model for NPR. So you know, after all this war shit, organizing for Iraq veterans against the war, now you're focused mainly, or you're also focused on environmental shit. You know, you were saying how everyone who was shooting at you was shooting at you over global warming. Mm. You know, what does that mean?
In Washington State, I'm working on these coal shipment ports. And so it's actually just as bad as the tar sands. They're digging up all this fucking coal that should not be dug up out of Wyoming, and they're shipping it to the West Coast. No one will buy it in America because we're closing all the coal plants, so they ship it to China. They also ship it to the Philippines and Indonesia and Vietnam, but for the most part, it's China. Now, there's a lot of problems with that. You lose 10% of the coal just in that train journey. Now, that's an economic loss. It's a capitalist loss. So the company should be concerned about that because they don't even have tops on them. You've all seen them traveling the country. But the bigger problem is that one of those goes down in the Puget Sound and it destroys the entire ecosystem. We're talking about 600,000 fishers that are employed. We're talking about jobs, whether it's oysters or, you know, you're talking about farms. Where this shit, the coal gets into the farms, the waterways, like, and then you have to ask a deeper question, like, is 10 jobs that helps, you know, permanent jobs that actually, like, help run a facility, is that worth, you know, environmental destruction that literally destroys hundreds of thousands of jobs and possibly destroys a place as an ecosystem where people can live? So growing up in Washington State in what we now, a lot of us call Cascadia, because of the specific bioregion that exists here, the soil types, there's 10 different soil types. It's the most diverse on the planet. The second best you can find is in like northern Russia, and it hasn't thawed yet. Life there is so directly in contact with nature. You're not dealing with Arizona. You're dealing with lush green everywhere. Water is influencing all forms of life. And so, you know, I remember being young and having my father, you know, 6-7 years old, grab me at the end of the day and try to focus me on the sunset as the sun dipped out over the ocean. And he would ask me, do you understand what this means? Do you appreciate this moment? Are you here right now? And as a kid, I've got ADD or whatever fucking we call it this year, and I'm jumping around and stuff. But that had a profound impact on me. It made me start appreciating and asking questions. And then when I saw the possibility of the lifestyle I grew up in or my parents grew up in threatened, I had a reaction like most human beings would have, like, don't fucking destroy my community. So for me, climate change was something I agreed with before I understood it. I was always upset by companies destroying water or destroying access to clean air or, you know, cutting down forests. I didn't understand what it meant for the world, but I understood what it meant for the place I was in. And it wasn't until I was in the military and you know, I met a guy overseas. We were, you know, I used to play chess as a way to pass time at night, and we'd talk about things. You know, we'd make our move, and we'd discuss where we came from and the issues that we thought were important and what we'd do when we came home. And this guy started telling me about climate change, or global warming, whatever polls better and makes you understand it better. And he was explaining to me how this planet is finite. But yeah, we may, once in a while, we have a meteor crash into it. We might have some, like, outside factors, but it's 0.001%. We're dealing with finite resources. And especially when we talk about oil, we're dealing with a resource that at least takes 10,000 to 15,000 years to develop. I mean, we're talking dead dinosaurs. That's why Sinclair gas stations have green dinosaurs in front of them. They're being honest. Thank you for at least being honest. So we're talking about a resource that we can't replenish in 20 years like we can with trees. And then he told me that we have an economic system that's based on infinite growth. And I never learned that in school. My parents, when they taught me about balancing my checkbook, never taught me that. And the fact that we have a finite planet based on infinite resources, that means at some point things don't jive. So to me, when climate really came into the news in 2006, 2007, for the people, of course, scientists have been talking about it since 1989, if not since the 50s and 60s, when Johnson had his first briefing on climate change in 1966. We've been approached by this issue, but we, you know, when you ask an American, like, what is the top issue in your life, it's usually like 20th, you know, because there's a job, clean water, you know, there's other issues that seem more pressing. Being in the military, and this kind of goes to a question you asked earlier about collapsed states and destroyed societies, I saw how communities react when the garbage isn't picked up. I mean, you think that's an arbitrary thing, but 3, 4, 5 weeks, your garbage isn't picked up. It's sitting on the side of the road. It stinks like hell. Nobody's taking it anywhere. Suddenly the water turns off. You know, maybe there's an explosion on the street. Maybe not. It doesn't matter because the infrastructure itself is collapsing. I started making connections. You know, at first it seemed like, oh, this is a war zone. It's Iraq. It's Afghanistan. It's just like, this is what happens in a destroyed society. But I started reading books. Novel idea. And I learned that this was happening everywhere. You know, like there's a few places where it's safe, but for the most part, it's happening all over the world. And when I look at what the climate does, which is like, I mean, really, for the last 11,000 years since the Ice Age ended, it's created this stable climate that human beings suddenly flourished in. This world is billions of years old, and human beings have only been around for about 250,000 years, and really only left created agriculture for the last 10,000 years. So our climate is intimately connected to everything we have, this recording that's going on, this technological development that we call a computer. This happened because of a stable climate that allowed us to settle and to build up resources and build new ideas. And have these reformations and revolutions of thought that we're pushing for now, you know. So when I, in about 2010, the United States Defense Department released what they call the Quadrennial Defense Review. And I would encourage everybody to read it. It's like 100 pages. It's incredibly in-depth. It happens every 4 years. And it's the military's attempt to predict the next 20 years. Predict who's in power, who are the threats to us, what does that mean for our military, how do we need to change and adjust economic powers, what are the threats, you know. And traditionally those threats have included things like, you know, North Korea or Iraq before we invaded, places that could destabilize a region from our perspective, hurt our interests. But in 2010, the entire Quadrennial Defense Review was about climate change.
Crazy.
And this is a review that was initiated by the Bush administration. This was put out by an administration that did not officially acknowledge that CO2 in the atmosphere raises the temperature of the planet, and that could be bad. I mean, that's just fucking science. It's not like, you don't get to disagree with that. It's fucking math.
Well, Bush disagreed with it, but he did the math anyway.
Well, come 2007, Bush actually did acknowledge climate change. And so that's, to me, that tells me that when you're sitting in that office and you're getting these briefings, these defense briefings every day, and they tell you that Mali is turning into a terrorist haven because it's too dry, or the Sahara is pushing down into the Sahel, which used to be the balance of Africa, and now you've got places like Sudan or Somalia or Eritrea in civil war, tearing themselves apart because they don't have enough water. They don't have enough food. These are real things. I mean, the QDR in 2010 could not have predicted how quickly their concerns would emanate. But let's talk about the Arab Spring. Tunisia had a massive four-year drought, or three-year drought. Syria was 4 years. And that contributed to the lack of jobs. It contributed to lack of agriculture they could produce. They continued exporting and stopped domestic production. So the people of the country that's producing the food on the limited lands that they couldn't even eat from it. And people get pissed. And you combine a little bit of WikiLeaks truth in that, and people fucking rise up. In Syria, it's even more prominent. There was a four-year drought. The original complaints prior to the Arab Spring, there were protests, and those protests were surrounded around the government not providing aid and support. The government came in. I mean, this is where you have corporate power, too. Corporations were making deals with the Assad government and finding ways to pick certain seeds and certain, you know, they wanted to make it a monoculture like they did with copper in Chile. So Syria faced a massive economic shortage to be able to fund their people and help their agriculture. And when the Arab Spring took off and a couple of kids went out and fucking painted some shit on walls, the place exploded. Everyone was ready to revolt. They were ready because they couldn't eat. So climate change is something that is absolutely right now affecting. I mean, I'm from Washington State. We can't sell oysters anymore. Our oysters have to be shipped to Hawaii at their birth for 6 weeks so that they can grow in less acidic water. The Puget Sound, which goes down by Seattle and down to Olympia, our capital, and along the Olympic Peninsula, one of the last tropical rainforests on the planet, it takes 7 years for that water to funnel. And it is the most polluted waterway in all of the United States. Because people think of the Pacific Northwest, they think it's epic and beautiful. It's the most polluted because it moves so slowly. So we can't even grow oysters anymore. So this is something that's the Defense Department is absolutely concerned with. Typhoon Haiyan. Who responded to that? The United States Navy did. When you have, and that was last year. You know, you've got once in a while we get like Katrinas or Sandys. Try those every year.
Yeah, I mean, when the shit hit Colorado, the flood this year, mm-hmm. they had, you know, helicopters ready. They had. I mean, they shut down cities. They had martial law in some places. Like, you couldn't get through the army without a checkpoint. I mean that shit's... It's crazy. And they said they were trying to prevent looting, but they were also trying to, like, keep people out of places. And, I mean, it's...
Well, and this speaks to your earlier question about militarization and the police. Our police have been instructed, they're being trained in military tactics. And I think this is a really important delineation between the history of the police. Now, let's understand, you know, you're Irish, right? A little bit Irish in you?
Yeah.
Okay, so,
enough. I'm
so
great, man.
As we go back in history, the Irish made this really great deal in the 1800s. And the deal was that, like, they could take on positions of power, like the police in the East Coast, as long as that they directed the hatred that was once directed at them towards people of color, primarily black people. When we talk about the police today, we're dealing with communities that a lot of them are vets. I wouldn't say a majority, but I'd say like a large percentage of them are veterans. They have this skill. So they're bringing this knowledge back from a war zone. But you also have a change in the mannerisms. Our police state was really created around controlling union workers. I mean, putting them down in the 1800s and controlling them, and the Irish played a huge role in that. I'd throw the Irish under the bus. There's great music and good beer.
Well, it makes sense that they would be an oppressive force. They were.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and that's, I mean, like that speaks Israelis. To the oppressors and the oppressed. Like, the oppressor or the oppressed become the oppressors at certain points if they don't make some key choices. But in terms of the police state, when we look at the change that's happened, the fundamental change is this. You see on the side of the car, serve and protect. And the police in the old days were willing to put their bodies in between the oppressor, the person with a gun, or the violent person, and the child, or the cat in the tree, or something like that. Now, the entire focus is just like the United States military. You protect the officer. You protect the police officer or the soldier. It is number one priority. You kill civilians, that's fine. Don't get your own men killed. And I say men because it's overwhelmingly men. There are women in the police force. There are women in the military. But in the military, it's like 12 to 14%. You know, we're not talking about equality here. So we've created a situation now where we have a police state that is behaving like it's an occupying force. And, you know, you see this in videos almost every week now where somebody's beaten to death or closely beaten to death. Like, people who are taking videos are accosted and beaten. It's exactly how I would behave in a war.
Yeah.
That's how I behaved. And, you know, it's one thing as a white American to understand you're doing that to brown people, you know, with the inherent white supremacy that's going on just in our hearts because of who we are and what culture we're born in. But the deeper part of it is that we're doing this to Americans, which on some level is totally irrelevant. But on another level, at what point do we pay attention? At what point do we draw a line?
These people are supposed to be like brainwashed, patriotic, you know, doing the right job. But then they're like beating the shit out of kids at Coors Field. You know, like, what the fuck? It's crazy. It's crazy. Well, in this report, though, I mean, you were saying it really informed your thinking. Like, what are the what does the Army think is going to happen in the next 20 years?
Well, the Army is interesting because, like, for all the military, I mean, I say the military in general, but the Army is the oldest part of the military.
Yeah, I mean the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah, I would say that the Defense Department is looking at this. They always look at things very pragmatically. Like, we got to give credit where credit is due. The Defense Department is interested in being right, having as few of its members killed and as much as the enemy killed. That's all they're interested in. People who are in politics decide where they go. So the military is, I wouldn't say amoral because it's trained to kill, but potentially could be shifted to other purposes, which we can talk about later. This report and subsequent reports. So, for example, it's 2014. It's, you know, August, right? Or almost August. And earlier this year, I think in March or April, the IPCC, or the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, released their seven-year report. They do these seven-year reports. This is a group of thousands of scientists who are all over the planet. They're primarily climatologists, but there's, like, you know, people who deal with water, people who deal with, like, other things. And this report is like government people and private corporations. They try to cover everything so nobody can argue with it. Of course, there's still in America people who argue, but they're idiots. This report is heavily influencing the United States. So this report came out and, like, gave some really dire predictions. Some of them being, you know, everything's based basically on two dates, 2050 and 2100. You know, if you go back to the 1990s, if we go back 20, 25 years, the predictions were that we would have a 2 degree Fahrenheit rise in by 2100. Okay. Now that would be pretty bad for us. But and you have to keep in mind 2 degrees is like the average. So you have like small at the equator and really massive at the poles. We're fucking way past that point now. And the Defense Department agrees. So the IPCC report comes out. A month and a half later, the U.S. government, the Obama administration, releases the National Climate Estimate. And this is a report that I would encourage everybody to look at. It covers the entire United States, state by state, region by region. What are the threats that people face, whether they're through, like, increased earthquakes, increased floods, drought, you know, lack of snow top on the mountains, which provide our clean water in a lot of cases, lack of access for dams. They spelled out a lot of these issues. These are domestic. So that's where your domestic threats are going to come, and we can pick out parts like Colorado or Washington, like, where I'm from.
Do they imagine the country staying together? Do they imagine it breaking apart? Do they imagine collapse? Are they looking at it that way?
Absolutely. So in 2010, the QDR report came out with 5 scenarios of how the world would be in 20 years. One of them, the best scenario for America, was unipolarity. United States unipolarity, meaning, like, we are the only superpower. We are still in charge. We still govern the world. Okay? That's one. 2, 3, 4 are varying degrees of losing that. 5 is anarchy, global anarchy. And it's not the cool kind that we want. It's the like, chaos. Somalia anarchy. They've predicted...
Yeah, I don't even know why they use that term, but anyway.
Well, that's a deeper discussion about leftist politics and failures, but...
So they picture government collapse just everywhere, 20 years.
Well,
That's one of their scenarios.
That's one of the options. I mean, like, and that scenario was like complete and utter collapse, where the United States has no influence and is basically like Homeland America protecting our borders and trying to like secure regions. So there's 9 bioregions in the United States. Like Cascadia, I mentioned earlier, was one of them. And the bioregions are based solely on like what the topography is, like the last ice age, how that determined things. Like Iowa is different than Illinois because the ice age like split the two states in half. So the food and water and access is different. So different parts of the United States have different estimates on like what they would call a sustainable population. And this would be a population that could grow things within a food and watershed of 25 miles. Okay, that's not a lot, but actually in terms of a food and watershed, that's a lot. Usually it's like a mile and a half when you determine that in the old days, like the hunter-gatherer days. So there's not a lot of plans for like, what do we do with the end of oil, or what do we do with... And I want to be clear, like there's been a lot of discussion lately about peak oil was a joke or it was wrong. It wasn't wrong. What happened is we found a bunch of technical fixes to things. You know, we had natural gas. We couldn't extract it anymore. We invented fracking. We have like not a lot of oil is easily accessible, but we have the tar sands. So these are ways to like, you know, scientifically cheat around the problem of like, you know, reaching the end of our, you know, limits. And the military is quite aware of this. So really when we look at...
That's why they made the Green Hornet.
I haven't seen the movie, but it's definitely...
No. They have like a natural gas attack airplane that's called the Green Hornet. It's green. They unveiled it on Earth Day.
Didn't see it. I've heard the military is developing...
I saw it on like a simulator episode.
Oh, goodness. Now, I've heard the military is developing, I mean, just from a like a tactical standpoint, the military doesn't want to have massive fuel lines following it. That's a target. So if you can, you know, dig up sand, turn it into water, like, that would be great. I mean, this isn't Batman, but, you know, that's a dream. But when the United States military looks forward over the next 20 years, what it's looking at is reacting to climatological problems. So, on one level, like the first thing I think of is like relief missions, like you had with Typhoon Haiyan and every typhoon that hits every year in the Philippines now in Bangladesh. But the deeper problem is what happens if you have a massive drought in southern Iraq and those people move to Jordan? You know, Jordan is a pretty dry country. Like they don't have the ability, they don't have the infrastructure to support those people. What if they feel like the Jordanians did something to them? I mean, you could pick any country in the world. You can like point out any part of this, but climate change is not so much the cause of these problems in the future. What it is it's what's called a forcing. So you have your problem. You know, you're not getting along with your spouse, right? That's your problem. Okay, and then suddenly one of you is unemployed and you can't pay the bills. That's climate change. That's the forcing. That's the thing that takes the problem that exists and pushes it to the point where something's going to happen and it's probably not going to be good. And that's what the United States military is looking at. The terminology mitigation is huge for them. Like, how do we mitigate threats? Not mitigate the effects of climate change or stop causing it, but mitigate the effects that directly affect the United States. And we have massive border issues right now. NAFTA cut down hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Mexican fishing jobs, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, those people are unemployed. And farmers.
Right? Corn farmers.
I mean, tons and tons of different people were fucked over. It's pretty impossible for me to imagine a non-militarized border in 20 years. In fact, I can't imagine a border that isn't 10 times as militarized as it is right now. I'm talking automated guns that shoot people that cross the no-go zone. You know, there's climate reports that are really... I mean, these things are really fucking scary. And I looked at reports from terrorists planning on blowing up nuclear bombs in New York, and I'm more scared of climate change because you can convince humans potentially, or you can lock them up, or you can kill them, or you can talk to them, you know. But Mother Nature, Gaia, the planet, whatever hippie bullshit you want to call it, like this ecosystem that we participate in, we have fucking flipped that balance. We're on the diving board, and we just keep duct taping extra feet on it, and we're just like, it'll be fine. And we're gonna fall in the fucking pool that doesn't have any water.
I mean, yeah, so what did people, I mean, what were the thoughts of Muqtada al-Sadr and, like, the Sadr army?
Well, the Sadr army, I mean, Muqtada is the son of a very famous cleric that resisted the Saddam administration and is the reason that he had the legitimacy that he did. He's Shia, okay? So it's important for listeners to understand that Iraq is majority Shia, and that's part of the reason that, like, Saudi Arabia is upset, and that's part of the reason that, like, you won't ever see Baghdad fall to ISIS, because ISIS is full of Sunnis, and 7 million Shia live, or 6 million Shia and, like, 1 million Sunni live in Baghdad. It'll just never happen. So Muqtada al-Sadr basically, like, sectioned off a part of Baghdad and declared it an enclave and was like, nobody's going to come in here. And that, you know, when the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, in 2003, 2004 was going on, that became, like, he hadn't, like, totally emerged at that point, but it was a threat, and it was something where people were like, okay, we need to, we can't have anybody, like, challenging our power. Had nothing to do with his values. I mean, he's an Islamist as much as Shia are. He's aligned with Iran. You know, I mean, I would just harken back to the point. I think, like, Che Guevara was a failure. Like, he's not
fucking, they liberated Cuba, dude.
No, he absolutely did. Yeah, he absolutely participated in a huge, awesome revolution over a massively corrupt Batista regime. And but the politics that he tried to export, they were specific to Cuba, even being in Argentine. Like, it was still specific to Cuba, and it worked to the extent that the revolution happened. We can talk about Cuba after, but that model did not work elsewhere. And you know, I would, you know, the analogy would be that, like, Sadr's reaction was, you know, good for the Shia districts, but it wasn't good for Iraq. It was never something that would have been adopted across the Middle East or anything. It was a very specific, homogenized ideology.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I think Americans, you know, I mean, and this is just me, I could be, you know, I'm sure, like, tons of vets would disagree with me on this, but I think he was just one of many targets, you know.
I guess my thing is, like, I just couldn't imagine being in the army and going up against the Sadr army in particular, like, mm-hmm. that movement, that nationalist movement, and just not being like, fuck, man, what the fuck are we doing? Like, these, you know what I mean?
Well,
like,
you're trained in the military to fight the Nazis. Like, you think the Nazis aren't committed? Find me somebody more committed. Like, you know, you gotta be pretty committed to be that fucked up mentally.
But not committed, like, committed on your home ground, like, you know.
Yeah, and that was their home ground. You know, I mean, this just speaks deeper to the indoctrination policy in the United States military. And if anybody, you know, listening to this is thinking about joining the military, they have family members thinking about joining the military, it's really important to understand that we've got about 10,000 years of military history that goes into the United States military's training. Whatever works, they will use it. They don't give a shit. It's not a moral question. It's about what's effective. And the U.S. military training is, like, much as people might roll their eyes, it's very effective. It is indoctrination, and you are trained to support the people around you. So when you hear things in the media later where it's like, oh, it wasn't about the politics, it was just about the buddies around me, that's training. We are trained to think that way. And, you know, tactically, the way we move, the way we fight, the way we clear rooms, all of that stuff is based on, like, being a collective. And this is why veterans can be organized. This is why they can be a fucking vital leftist force in this country, if we choose to be open enough to, like, receive them and work with them. These are people that won't have to go to be libertarians, won't have to go to be Tea Party members. We can move these people, and they've got tactics that we need. So in terms of facing off against the Sadr army, I mean, it could have been aliens. Like, the people in these units are trained to fucking take on the enemy. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter how fucking tough they are. There's no, like, I mean, it's like, bring it the fuck on. Bring it the fuck on. We've been trained for this. This is my job. Like, this is my Super Bowl. I don't want to miss this. There's not a lot of political thinking at that point.
That's crazy. Yeah, I always hear that about the military. It's like, you're like, oh, no, that's political. You know, it's like, dude, you're in another country with a fucking gun. Like, that's pretty goddamn fucking political.
Well, no, I mean, no, it's not, though, in the way that our system is structured. the American, we have a civilian in charge of the military. We have an American population that elects representatives. Those representatives in the House and in the Senate determine when we go to war. Okay, the president is not supposed to determine when we go to war. The House and Senate determine when we go to war. Those are the representatives of the people. The U.S. military is separated from that intentionally. It is not political. It is a force for good or evil or whatever the fuck the civilians want to use it for. So when I hear people being like, oh, you fucking joined the military, you're a war criminal, I'm like, yes, because you sent me there. You sent me there and you ordered me to be a war criminal and I did my duty. Yes,
but that's
sir.
That's assuming the people have any control over their government.
Yeah, I mean, that is assuming, but I mean, I think, I don't give a shit if you're in North Korea. I think the North Koreans still have some control over their government. If everybody stopped participating in the system, like, it may not be possible. Consent is a really difficult thing to withdraw, but it's, again, a math equation. This is something that can be done, and you're telling me it's more difficult for the American public to fucking remove their consent or vote or participate in, I mean, not that voting fixes things, but to participate in some way that obstructs the war machine. You're telling me it's more difficult for them to do that than for an American soldier who will be shot in the back of the head if they refuse an order in a war zone? Like, that's some fucking whack shit.
Well, it's a volunteer army also. So
it is an all-volunteer army, and it is an economic draft. So what we did after Vietnam was we realized that the public had a massive reaction. We didn't call up the Guard or Reserves in Vietnam. So in 1976, the U.S. Army goes to town, or the U.S. military goes to town and starts saying, what can we do? So what do? They start adding bonuses. Like, if you have a wife, you get married, you get a bonus. If you have kids, you get support. We'll take care of your health care. We'll pay for the whole family, not just you. We'll make sure their education's paid for. We'll provide you a house. We'll subsidize, like, a car. We'll provide you with this access. If you get in the military, you have a baby, and you're going to stay in the military. You know, and if you're going to join the military, like, here's the people who join the military. People of color who join the military are working class people primarily. We have statistics on this. The working class people of color, which is a small minority, much smaller than Vietnam. It's actually lower than the percentage in America. The only minority group that's higher than its population in the military is Native Americans. But all black, Latino, they're all lower. Now, we think about, you listen to Immortal Technique or you, like, hear, you know, music, like, you think, oh, the black and Latino, that's the military. It's not. It's white male. 77% is white male. Now, why is that? These are middle class kids joining, white male middle class kids.
It's a white Christian army.
It is. It's Dominionist. There's a lot of Dominionist. I think there's a lot of, like, I want to impress dad. I mean, that sounds stupid and simplistic, but I think there's, like, lineage, history, you know, identity totally wrapped up in this. And, like, grandpa went to World War II or grandpa went to Vietnam, you know, and people want to, like, check that box. I want to be a man. And this speaks to a larger cultural concern. No, I mean, this speaks to the cultural concern of, like, we don't know what masculinity is. We don't know what healthy masculinity is. We don't have, like, passageways. Like, native cultures, other countries, they have ways to pass boys into manhood. We don't have that. You get a car, you fucking, you know, you can buy beer, you can get porn at 18. That's not a generational passage. The military provides that. You go in as a boy, you come out as a man. Same with women. Women, you know, girl, become a woman. So that's something that we need to provide other avenues in our culture for. Otherwise, you're going to continue to have people joining the military. Because if you can tell me right now that you're a working class person, you have no future but being a bricklayer or whatever the fuck you're going to do, you're going to make $20,000 a year, and you can join the military and enter the middle class immediately. Healthcare, coverage for your kids, a steady paycheck, no bills, you know, discounts on everything, 10% off everything you buy. Who the fuck is going to say no to that? This is the part with climate change. Like, people's personal issues are more important to them than the greater good.
Have you heard the statistic that in the last couple of years, more upper class kids have been joining the army? This argument, I don't know if it sounds like a right wing argument. I'm just wondering.
I haven't. I mean, ideal anecdotally, I probably have access to 2,000 veterans at most over the last 4 years, you know, and that's a lot, but, like, you know, I would say most people hover. there's very few rich kids that join. Once in a while, there's somebody who wants to prove themselves, but usually it's like the, like I said, the middle class white guys, and then like working class people of color, and then women who are like I said, 12 to 14%, they make up of the military. But I think it's really important to understand, like 77% of our military is white male. Like that, that is really interesting. I don't know what that means. You know, you guys can decide what that means, but.
You were earlier, you were talking about, you know, it was the civilians who sent you in there, you know. You used the term civilian.
Right.
You know, what does that mean? Like, what's a fucking civilian?
Well, civilian's anybody that didn't serve in the U.S. military.
We used to call civilians people who'd come to our shows.
So maybe civilian is a non-professional.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, in the military, the term civilian is pretty derogatory. And it's interesting because there's a lot, you know, not everything's black and white. So on the one hand, the U.S. military is supposedly there to protect the American people, the civilians, the people who can't help themselves. Or save themselves, right? But on the other hand, we despise civilians in the military. We just hate them. I mean, you're worthless. You don't get up early. We get more done by 9 a.m. than you do all day. Like, you're just a waste of space. You're working. I mean, and this is interesting because in the military, there's a lot of criticism of like corporations, or a lot of criticism like Blackwater, Triple Canopy, these private military contracts. There's also criticism of like General Electric or Lockheed Martin. These people who make billions of dollars. There's criticism of jobs or lifestyles that are not, quote-unquote, like, hardworking and worthwhile. Now, that can extend to, like, police or bricklayers, like, physical labor, but it also extends to people who, you know, use a bad phrase, people who are in the trenches. And so, you know, most people in the military do, like, I mean, the military is an incredibly class-based system. So when you want to reach military personnel on class issues, it's pretty easy. They've experienced it. There's officers. There's enlisted. There's a rank structure. And when they come back into this society, they see people in the rank structure that didn't deserve it. They see people in charge of things that are incompetent. They see people's inability to make decisions, to be spontaneous, to react to things, to have to, like, people have to go to fucking meetings to decide something. It's like, we're being mortared. Make a decision, motherfucker. Make the bad decision, that's fine, but make a decision. So there's a lot of frustration. Some of it's, like, irrational, but I would say the deeper part of this is if you subscribe to what you were taught in your American civics class in high school, and you understand the branches of government, the judicial and executive and legislative, and you understand the civilian control of the military, because we in the military are very educated about this, that we get told this a lot. We get told about our place. You know, there's a lot of restrictions on whether we can talk to press or, you know, be in public. We can't. We can't wear our uniforms in certain areas. All of this is to protect the separation of decision making. So in a lot of countries, you see, like, the military, like Pakistan, for example, or Chile, like, the military makes political decisions, takes over the government, and runs things. Our government is set up in a way to dissuade that or prevent that. It doesn't mean it can't happen, but the military generally operates very respectfully towards the president. They kind of, you know, towards the executive, they're like, okay, this is your decision, you know, here's our advice. Sometimes they're pushy, but the people like me, the working class of the proletariat of the U.S. military, we understand very clearly, just from personal experience, when we come home, okay, and we've just gone to war for fucking 14 months, ostensibly for the American people's freedom and liberty and all this shit, and we can't even find an American who can point a rock on a map. Or an American who can pronounce Afghanistan. Or an American who gives a fuck about our health care. Or an American who has any idea of what it's like to carry a 100-pound pack on your back every fucking day. We don't encounter those people. So when we come home, we've already understood that the American people don't care and we're doing this for the good of them. And then we come home and see it firsthand. And, you know, that's why we have a third of our homeless population are veterans. That's why we have 22 veterans.
Is that a real statistic?
Yes. It's more than that. It's actually, like, it's closer to 50%. It's about 42%. You know, 22 veterans kill themselves every day. Like, that's you know, that tells you that that war itself is traumatic. We've been told a story. The World War II vets, they came home, they got to work. They just went to work and they built America. You know what they did? They came home from World War II. 6 million of them went to college under the GI Bill. They came home and they beat their wives. They beat their children. They fucking set up destructive corporations that created this fucking world we have. They created the opportunity for someone like Richard Nixon to get fucking elected president. And then Ronald Reagan. Like, we had... You want to talk about structural destruction... You know, the Vietnam veterans came home. They actually got acknowledged. And I didn't even mention Korea, because that's what we do. We don't mention Korea. But these vets have always come home. When you, the term red tape, that comes from the Civil War. Red tape refers to the tape that was bound around veterans' medical reports that was hidden in Washington. If I served in the Civil War, I had to travel to Washington, find my file, prove that I'd been injured in combat physically. There's no psychological. Don't shut up, pussy. You know, like, you need a physical injury to be really injured in the Civil War. And then I had to go get it fucking reviewed by a fucking three officer panel who'd probably reject it because we didn't have the budget for it, because it's, you know, Ulysses S. Grant is president. He's a racist. There was no support for veterans. I mean, we had almost a revolution in this country in the 1930s by veterans. We had veterans camp out in D.C. under the Hoover administration and then under the FDR administration. The Bonus Army, tens of thousands.
They were gunned down, weren't they?
They were gunned down by General Douglas MacArthur, a war hero from World War II. He got his stripes back when he invaded the Philippines after losing them. But we these are World War I vets, right? They come home from the war. They're promised a bonus. Now, here's the caveat. The bonus is not going to be until, like, the 1940s. But it's the fucking Great Depression. And they served America. And they come together and they're like, we need bonuses. We can't feed our families. They brought their families, their kids, their wives to these camps right outside D.C. And they protested for years. And they finally got their bonus after being fucking executed by Douglas MacArthur, after being, you know, tear gassed and shot at. I mean, veterans, if you look at movements around the world, veterans play a fucking fundamental part. You look at Tiananmen Square, there was Chinese veterans. That's what gave them legitimacy. That's why they didn't get gunned down for the first week. They did eventually, but, like, veterans provide that extra sentence. They make the Republicans listen to you for an extra moment. They provide a legitimacy. They can stand in front of the protest and take the bullets. Like,
no, that was what was powerful about Occupy Oakland, man. Yeah. You know, I mean, talk about Scott Olson, but it's like, man, I remember watching that video and just seeing the American right. flag and being like, man, motherfuckers are going to eat this shit up. Like, this is crazy, mm-hmm. you know?
And the American flag's, I mean, an interesting...
You know what's up with that. Like, you yeah. talk about that. You talk about, like, being at the DNC and, like, waving your flag at the SWAT team yeah. and watching them cry.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, yeah. Yeah, there's a power, and again, like, the police are intimately linked with the military, so there's a relationship that we can exploit that doesn't exist there for a lot of other people, you know? No offense, like, I generally dress pretty dishevelly, but, like, when I deal with police, I dress like a professional, and I look like I deserve their respect, and they respect me. When I get pulled over for a DUI, I get away with it, because I can fucking talk like a veteran. So we have a lot of privilege, too, that needs to be talked about, but it needs to be used. It doesn't need to be fucking torn apart and pointed in the corner and, like, we beat you because you're a veteran. No, we need to use that. That's our obligation. We have a privilege. Let's use that. We also have trauma. Let's fucking understand that and heal from that. You know, there's, I mean, again, life is nuanced. It's not fucking simple and black and white.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's what, you know, that's how Scott Pruitt talks about anarchism also. It's like, we're not, you're not insurrectionary, you're not a communist, you're not green, right. you're all these, you can be all these things. Well, I mean, another thing is, you know, in the Vietnam War, World War II, if you got shot, you're fucking dead. Whereas, like, yeah. these new wars, it's like they're bringing motherfuckers home, and yep. they gotta pay for them, and, like... Do you know statistics?
Absolutely, yeah. So in World War II, and this is a huge study that was done after World War II by the Defense Department, and they found that a high percentage, upwards of 50% of soldiers in World War II, American soldiers, would, upon receiving fire, like gunfire from the enemy, would drop their weapons and run away. like upwards of 50%. Very high. This is a really bad deal for the Defense Department.
It's like the Napoleonic Wars.
Right. Also. Anyway. So they started like asking questions like, why is this? How can we, you know, prevent this? They did a study. They found that 52 days of sustained combat. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, fucking Hitler versus FDR. It just means like, you know, getting fire, understanding you're under stress. You're 52 days. They had a 98% failure rate psychologically. The 2% that weren't a failure,
sociopaths,
pathological, sociopathic, crazy, out of their mind. Yeah. Now, I would venture to guess we have actually like a higher percentage of that now, because especially in 2005, we started bringing in a lot of people who had criminal records, and like we needed anybody to go to Iraq. So now in terms of looking in the next couple of, you know, 60, 70 years, we've had a lot of struggles with psychological breakdown. But in terms of, well, what was the question? What was the
vets are surviving.
Right.
They come home to be homeless.
Right.
Like before you would die, you know, they couldn't fly you out. Now it's like you
right, know. Right. So so in World War II, it was about a day and a half average for if you're injured to get out, you know, to get to a medical facility. In Afghanistan in 2009, 2010, it was 18 minutes. So you get injured, a medevac is called, it's already probably on station, meaning it's waiting for injuries in a best case scenario. It comes and picks you up, takes you to the hospital, and you can get, you know, helped. So we've got thousands, and we have about 4,500, I don't want to fuck up the numbers, but it's 4,600 dead in Iraq, over 2,000 in Afghanistan. You know, it's in the tens of thousands of people who are physically injured and in the hundreds of thousands for psychological injuries. So, for example, the Defense Department in 2010 or 2011, I can't remember exactly, the total of active serving people, this is not veterans, active serving people was 400,000 traumatic brain injuries and 250,000 with traumatic or with post-traumatic stress.
That's crazy.
And that's fucked because if you have a TBI, if you have traumatic brain injury, you have PTSD. So the idea that we have more TBIs than post-traumatic stress is fucking wrong. So add 400,000 to the 250,000 and you've got an idea. And that's active duty military out of a military of maybe less than 3 million. So you're talking about a third of the military that is psychologically traumatized. And those are the people who admit it or can't hide it.
Right.
You know, now let's talk about the whole population. 2.8 million have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. It doesn't require you to serve in a war zone to be traumatized. Our sexual assault rates are 1 in 3 women are sexually assaulted while they're in the military. 1 in 7 men. Okay. There's actually more men total that have been sexually assaulted than women because of the per cap, you know, because of the numbers of men in the military. Men don't report it even more than women do. So you have that, you have this, the physical and psychological abuse that goes into training. You know, there's plenty of abuse that I experienced that,
And not much has actually, that hasn't moved. Nothing has really happened with that.
No, there's definitely been more investigations around sexual assault, but it's still nowhere near addressing the issue. I mean, the bottom line of all of this is like you have trauma from war. If you go to war, it doesn't matter how justified. I mean, remember, Afghanistan was the good war. If you go to war and you have to take human life, that is a biological, a evolutionary, a human nature violation. You are fucking with hundreds of thousands of years of evolution when you kill another human being.
Right.
Okay? And that's not addressed. If we talked about this in the way that it's actually the problem, which is that going to war causes trauma, which should make sure that if we go to war, it's for our very survival. It is because, like, Stalin is in Mexico and he's coming across the border and he's going to rape everybody. Like, that should be the only time we go to war. And that does, and it especially means we shouldn't have a police force that prosecutes its operations like they're in a fucking war with the American people. And this is why, like, I don't understand why there's not enough connection, especially among, like the Occupy movement. Like, there are connections, but, like, there should be a revolutionary, you know, wake up here. Like, the police forces are the military, but they're sans Iraq or sans Afghanistan. They're here. You know, they shoot a little less. Yes. They shoot a little less. They got the same equipment. They're operating under the same... I mean, like, cops are not your fucking friends. You know that. I don't need to lecture you.
I mean, you know, I've
but I mean, if you met me in Afghanistan, you should... You're not my friend either.
Right.
That's the point is, like, it doesn't mean that I'm a bad person. Like... I was trying to do the right thing. I raised my right hand because I love this country and I love the ideas that we have, like, talked about and never fucking produced. And I was blind enough to think that we had produced them and that we had to defend them by killing bin Laden and then Saddam. You know, I made a mistake. I was wrong, and I'm spending the rest of my life making up for that.
Well, hey, man, if anybody has, you know, you guys can stick it to the empire, and I'm glad you're doing it, man. So...
Fuck yeah.
Any last words before we go eat some spaghetti?
Yeah. So we're actually having our 10-year anniversary this summer in like 2 weeks. We're having Iraq Veterans Against War is having its convention. We'll be talking about changing our name to more represent the membership and like look forward to the future.
Oh, you're going to change the name?
Yeah. Well, we're looking to be more inclusive of all the veterans who've come home, not just Iraq veterans, because the majority is actually like Afghanistan. You know, we've got people in Libya. We've got people who've non-deployed, but done like operations in Korea and Japan and Kosovo. I mean, we've got, you know, this is the U.S. military. We've got 177 bases, yeah. You know, like, or 177 countries in with bases. So, like, yeah, we're trying to be more representative. We talked about militarism and we're addressing militarism, but really, like, for me, my hope is that we can. You know, my last anti-militarism work that I'm going to do is going to be ending the war in Afghanistan. We need to bring those, you know, we got 130,000 people there. Now, 30,000 are contractors, 100,000 contractors, 30,000 soldiers. So when you hear that we've only got 30,000 troops, that's bullshit. We have 100,000 private troops.
Just means we're spending 10 yeah. times more money.
It means 13,000 tax-free a month. That's what I was offered when I left the military in 2007. I'm sure it's more than that now. And these are people who have all of the skills that people in the military have, but no accountability. So at least in the military, we can try you. If you're a contractor like Blackwater or Z or whatever the fuck they're called this week, like, you're not accountable. You can go to Dubai. So for me, I want to end the war in Afghanistan. And when we bring those troops home, I want to fucking find employment for those troops. And I want to put them to work on climate change. Because if there's anything that is a world issue, a world war, it's climate. And... You know, this could be the thing. We're at the moment, we got to unify, we got to find ways for countries to come together. And we can't just be, like, ideological. And I mean that to the communists, the anarchists, the socialists, like, on the left. We can't be ideological. We got to do whatever the fuck works to keep us alive. And we got to buy time so we can make a better world. Because right now, we're looking at the fucking edge of the cliff.